All right, we're gonna go ahead and get started. Thanks everybody for coming. We have about 40 to 45 minutes to talk about range walking. My name is David Orbueso. I work as a performance engineer at SUSE, mainly dealing with kernel bottlenecks and the likes. Today we're gonna talk about an introduction as to why we need range walking, what is range walking. We're going to go through some of the semantics that it involves when comparing to a regular lock. We're going to see how range locks perform versus regular read-write semaphores. We're going to see how these results made us look into tree optimizations, and finally, what's left for us to upstream this. So we need range walking because in ideal scenarios, it simply enables parallelism for non-overlapping ranges. In a regular lock, if you don't take that into account, you won't really be able to parallelize anything. The flagship example, and really why I'm trying to push this, is because we can enable parallelism for address space operations on non-overlapping segments of the range. Like when any system call where you pass a size, for example, like memlock, whatever, that's what I'm talking about. So we have a start and we have a from, and if we have two threads that are doing operations on different ranges of that address space, there's no point in them not being parallel. So the main caveat about this is that while I call it a range lock, it's not really a lock in the traditional way, but it is called a lock because it provides mutual exclusion. If you picture range locking, you can basically look at this. Here are two examples. The first is there are W1 and W2 are different ranges, and on the left side you see that there are some overlaps. And on the right side, you see that there are no overlaps. So when I'm talking about ranges and all, in your mind, like just think about this. So regular locking involves compare and exchange type of semantics that can be X hat as well for semaphores. But that's in the traditional way. In a single atomic compare and exchange, you can provide mutual exclusion. And that's pretty well known. But the serialization for range locking is given by controlling forward progress of each task as they add themselves or a node into an interval tree. And interval trees in the kernel are basically an augmented red-black tree. I don't know if anybody knows, probably do, but the Corman book, Algorithms. Our kernel implementation is basically a text example from that book, whether it be interfaces or semantics that we rely on for the correctness of the interval trees. Here's another way to look at interval trees and ranges. Up top, we have a series of ranges, can be overlapping or whatnot, but the random, from 0 to 30 being the smallest to the largest values within the whole tree. And that's really represented below in the interval tree. We have the augmented really is what gives us the actual ranges, and the value for the red-black tree, the key would be the value below each node. For example, the root node has 30. The first left node has 23, which is basically the largest value in the range within that subtree. So we mainly use a reference counting mechanism to identify any overlapping ranges or not in the tree. So when we're going to do a lock, we'll first have to see, before adding itself to the tree, any intersecting ranges, and we'll have the counter based on that. And that counter will give us a lot of more details later for things like ordering and freedom of starvation. So when you unlock, you also have to first remove yourself from the tree and then see how many overlapping ranges your node that you removed are blocking other threads. So we always do it like just without accounting for current. That's important because if we accounted for current, we'd be always deadlocking. So any task that's adding itself to the tree, if that value of the reference counter is non-zero, then you have to wait. In this case, we block. Reference counting really this way provides us to have a FIFO ordering for overlapping ranges. So I gave a small example that came up on LKML when I last sent the version of this patch. So assume we have a lock held by task A and with a range of A and N, and well that's the lock owner. And then another thread B comes in with trying to lock itself for ranges G and Z. So there's obviously an overlap there for GZ. And since there's only one overlap, or at least in this case, there's one node in the tree and it overlaps, we have the reference for GZ as one. And since A is the lock owner, the reference for A and N, that range, is obviously zero because it's running. So while thread B is trying to wait for A, let's assume thread C comes in with B and M ranges. That's also an intersection. Since it intersects with the range for A and the range for B, the reference count for C would be 2. So then let's say thread A drops the lock. That means it unaccounts for itself in the tree. And therefore, the reference from GZ would be 0, and the reference from BM would be 1, after we subtract 1 from each. And therefore, thread B would be getting the lock instead of A. I'm saying instead of C. So that's kind of what I'm talking about with fairness and FIFO ordering. The first in, first out. In this case, A was first. C has to wait for. I'm sorry, B was first before C, so C has to wait for B. For non-overlapping ranges that are in the tree, say we have a range that was blocking everybody and it removes itself, so there are a few nodes that are good to go where the reference count makes 0. But who's going to get the lock in that case? Those semantics basically rely on the tree traversals in order. So whenever, depending on the size of your range, you will get the lock or not. Starvation-wise, we don't have starvation simply because there's no lock stealing, and everything is serialized by a tree lock. This lock has a reader-writer semantics. It originally started out by only readers, but since I'm particularly needed for read-write semaphores, it had to also have shared semantics. The only key to this is to basically, if you have an intersecting node in the tree, and if it's a reader, just don't account for it. So that very nicely gives us a way of sharing and having exclusive rights on the tree. For this, in order not to enlarge data structures, we just use the significant bit in task struct, so basically pointer tagging. Now, that was the first part in the semantics and all, but the actual interfaces require two steps from the caller or the user, because first it has to prepare the range, and then you actually do the lock or unlock. We have the same calls, and we have a lock, try lock, interruptible, killable, etc. So we're basically up to par with what read-write semaphores offer, as well as locked up. So here in for every call of the range lock, you pass the tree, which is your global data structure. And you pass the range lock you wanna acquire. Usually, the actual range lock itself is going to be stack allocated, because it's just the function that needs it. And the actual shared variable is the tree structure, which would be the one where all threads are contending on. So having the actual lock stack allocated gives us a lot of, we don't have to really deal about concurrency with that, as long as the user respects that. If it doesn't, you'll probably run into trouble. Here's a really easy example. So you declare a range. You initialize it. In this case, from 10 to 100, those are just arbitrary values. The actual ranges start from 0 all the way to the highest number, whether it be 32-bit or 64-bit. So with that initialized, you basically acquire the lock, do something, and then release it. But I just wanted to show how it looks like as opposed to a regular spin lock or a downright. Now, because I'm so interested in replacing MAPSEM, we need to actually see how we perform compared to a regular rewrite semaphore. And performance-wise, if you compare it one-to-one, it will always be worse than a rewrite semaphore because we have a lot of optimizations there and we really can't implement the logic we want for range lockings in a single instruction, like is the case for for semaphores. So range locks don't really have fast paths. That XADD for on an uncontended semaphore is enough to acquire the lock. That's not the case for range locking because at the least you have a spin lock and unlock and in between some loads for the tree variable. The tree structure, sorry. So you'll always incur in more penalty on the range lock than you would on a regular lock. But that's okay because the idea is to improve parallelism. So in the long run, if you actually do the conversion and it's a suitable user, you can get a lot more than you would in regular locks. Range locks don't have optimistic spinning either, which semaphores do. Semaphores didn't used to have optimistic spinning either. Now we currently have reader optimistic spinning. There's also patches for write optimistic spinning. There are also patches for reader optimistic spinning, but this changes a bit how the actual system behaves in that for the conversion on range locks, you'll always block. So you can have a lot more context switches on a workload than you would have on a regular lock. In semaphores, we try very hard not to block. Nor do we favor writers over readers or vice versa. In the case of semaphores, there are cases where we can favor writers over readers, or when you do a wake up, there's also a place where when you unlock and you do a wake up, you can wake up many readers, just because you know that the next time is going to be okay and that the reader is going to acquire the lock. But in this case, we can't really do that kind of thing because that means we have to know about the ranges and we don't know necessarily. Actually, we're going a little fast. Are there any questions yet? I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. Dynamic will increase the range? No, but I'm not sure I see a point where that would be needed. Because once it's in the tree, it's there, and you're not going to change it until you unlock it. So if you do a lock on a range, and then you're going to alter that range, you really can't account for it, and you can't guarantee mutual exclusion.
No, I mean, say... I grab the lock for range from 1 to 10, and then I want to do an operation from 10 to 20. Now, because I am on CPU, then it is better for me to give the CPU to do operation from 10 to 20. So in that case, it will be better to increase the range instead of going releasing the lock and then grabbing the lock again for range 10 to 20, right?
Maybe, but also remember that each range is represented by a thread. So how would you differentiate if you like combine the ranges? I think I understand your point, but there's that thing that we need to associate a range with a thread always.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's actually towards the end. It's on my to-do, but it's a less urgent to-do because the lock does give us some pretty nice guarantees. But I think it could be done. I'm just not sure at this point how. But yeah, I've thought of it. Here's some. I basically did two experiments. These are synthetic workloads. A thing called lock torture. You basically, for random periods of time, you acquire and release locks. While they're random, the seed is the same, so you can compare experiments. There are short haul times, there are long haul times, and it really depends on how you look at the representation of that from different workloads. I mentioned these are synthetic because more realistic workloads are being measured, but that's obviously always the thing we care about. But synthetic workloads lets us at least look at a thing on a one-to-one basis and see how we are in the very worst case scenarios. All these results are using a full range, so therefore there's no parallelism. It's just basically seeing how we're comparing against the semaphore on the worst case scenario. So for a small box on a write-only workload, it's pretty obvious that the difference is insignificant, which is very good. It's something like a 3% penalty for range locking. That's overall throughput of how many times the lock was acquired. And below is the amount of threads. So for 2, 4, and 8 threads on a 4-core box, there's no really any difference. In every experiment, I basically tried out the half amount of the cores, the full core usage, and doubling it. Now for the read-only case, you can still see it's pretty much the same, but there is like double penalty, like 6% regression for range locking, which isn't bad. It's still within the acceptable margins.
For the test scenario that you're showing, is the lock basically always held, or are there time periods where it's not held?
It's always held. Well, you mean like when the lock's uncontended?
Yes. Where some of the time it's uncontended.
So
then you get the win from the fast acquire on the mm-hmm. non mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. on the other scenario.
Yeah, that's true, and I actually think that the two thread case represents what you're saying. And the one to the far left, that's pretty much uncontended.
So how are the threads acquiring and releasing? You know, what meaningful work do they do while they hold it and while they don't hold it?
We basically spin or block for a random period of time.
Do you also block between when you release the lock and when you reacquire it?
Yes.
Okay.
But in general, the lock is always being acquired. That's the main purpose of the experiment. So Now, mixing readers and writers, in this case, you have to compare the red bar, sorry, with the green bar with the blue bar. The green bar with the blue bar, which are the writer threads, and the yellow bar with the orange bar, which are the reader threads. In this case, you see the 2, 4, and 8 threads. The actual amount of threads is divided between readers and writers. So in the 2 case, you have 1 reader and 1 writer. 4 case, you have 2 readers, 2 writers, etc. Here we start seeing some of the potential regressions when we go on a higher amount of thread basis. Like in the 8 core, you see that the read write sim writer thread got a significant better chunk of overall acquiring the lock than the range one did. But again, that's okay because this is a very much a worst case scenario. Similar for the 2-thread case, you see that the reader ranges also impact in negatively in the read-write semaphore. You get basically a lot more locks acquired. So the other box I tried it on was a 240 core machine. Now this one will show a lot more the performance penalties on a one-to-one basis. The throughput for the range lock is more than half the read-write semaphore for 120 threads. It actually gets better as you go adding them. That's probably just because the overall contention, the overall results are because we're basically contending on the tree lock. So there's not much to rescue from that. But the pattern does show that we take a hit in the lowest case. And actually, that's pretty similar to the write behavior we had with the 4-core box, only that it was a lot less pronounced. This is the read only. I should have labeled that better. That's the write only. I'll fix that. In the read case, actually, things are a lot better. We still take some hits, but not so much as the writer case. And combining, we also see the similar patterns of the 4-core machine in that the amount of writer threads for the read-write semaphore are significantly higher than the ones for the range lock. And actually, in this case, the range lock for the readers outdid the semaphore case. And that pattern is seen in the 120, 240, and 480 thread counts. So given these results, yeah?
On the previous 2 slides, could you explain why in that case the 120 threads had worse performance than more, but in the write only it had better performance than more? No, go. So that one versus the previous slide?
This one.
So there the semaphore had much better performance at 120 threads than it did with more, but in the read-only case it had worse performance. Can you explain why the difference?
You mean here?
No, that one.
That one. No, it's the exact same pattern. They both take hits.
But there, it looks like with 120 threads, the purple line is much higher than the other ones. If you go to the other slide.
Right, okay. You mean, why is it higher in 120 than it is in 240 and 480?
Yes, where read only was the other way around.
Yeah, that's probably because you're adding more contention to the lock, to the tree lock, so you're basically spending your time there.
Wouldn't they both have the same amount of contention for the tree lock?
Well, in the case of your 120, you have half the cores idle. So you also have issues with cache line bouncing and
but,
whatnot.
But wouldn't the same hold true for the read-only case?
This one.
Yes.
Trying to remember why it was that way. No, I don't think I can give you an answer right away.
Okay.
But the, right, so like the Longman is saying in the writer case you have to wait for the lock, and in the reader case you basically do the spin lock and you're done.
Okay, I can see that.
So with these results, we started looking at ways to. Mm-hmm. Could you repeat that?
So in this test, where there are both readers and writers, so what would be a ratio between readers and writers?
They're half and half. Yeah.
We can try and get the multiple tests. Most of the cases, the writer percentage is really low. We can try
that. Yes. Which is why I say that these are synthetic. The true numbers actually come with the actual real-world workloads. That data is being gathered, but preliminary results show, like on for a kernel build, okay, a regression of like 3% overall. So, but we do need a lot more numbers on other workloads. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That, and again, that's also on towards the end of my to-do.
Okay.
So we did basically two optimizations to get the numbers a little bit better. One is already upstream, the other is still pending. So every time we take the lock, we try to see how many overlapping nodes we have in the tree, and for that we have to do a full traversal every time. The idea is to avoid some of the log n tree walks down. In this case, you can actually determine without having to walk the tree if there are any overlapping ranges or not. You basically take you need the smallest start and the largest end for the entire tree to know that. It's basically the subtractions seen for the overlap case, and in the on the right case you have non-overlapping to the left, but you can also have non-overlapping to the right. So in this case, there are two conditions that have to be met. So for that, we basically need to get a hold of, in this case, 1 and node 27. Obviously, we can't go down the tree and pay the penalty for those things, so we basically need to cache. For the smallest one, we cache the leftmost node. This is not new. The scheduler has been doing this for a while, block.io as well. But what we did was unify those and actually allow the interval tree to use it. For that, we created three new interfaces, which are extensions from the regular red black tree stuff, basically a cached. We always have the leftmost node in constant time. Now, for the rightmost, the one with the largest value, we can also cache it, but that means that there aren't that many users in the kernel that actually care about the largest one. So caching that is basically going to enlarge the footprint for the common case, which we don't want. Fortunately, interval tree semantics allow us to have the last in subtree. So if you apply that to the node, to the root node, you'll get the largest value in the tree. So we have that. And with that, we can actually determine intersections real fast without having to actually touch the tree. This landed in recently before FortNet 14. The second optimization was threaded RB trees. This is nice because it allows in order traversals not having to revisit parent nodes. For example, if you're on node E and then you want to get the next in order value, right now you have to go back up the tree for that. But with threaded RB trees, you really don't. You just have the next one, and if it's a thread, which is the dotted lines, we need to handle that. We need to be able to differentiate between a thread and a real node, so we can know when to stop iterating for like insertions or lookups. This is allowed because RB trees have n plus one null children nodes, so instead of just having them null, we can reuse them and giving us threads. So basically, we also tag the RB node pointer, and that way we can tell apart threads and nodes. This is a regular way of inserting a new node into the tree. Unfortunately, for threaded trees, every single caller has to be updated, which is a major pain. But here, basically, we're looking for the link towards the bottom. And the actual link we get for the return is the link where the new tree is going to, the new node is going to be added, and then we rebalance. So my first approach was to basically convert the following the RB left and RB right to be able to internally see if we're dealing with a thread or not. Now, if we are dealing with a thread, we need to be able to stop. And with that condition, in the while, it's a little tricky because if you return, say, an RB left, if you return null, indicating that it's a thread, you're going to run into problems with that. So this basically means we need to create a third interface for controlling when to stop the tree iterations. That's kind of pending because I actually don't like having to do that. I haven't been able to think of any other smarter way of doing it. But it involves an unnecessary another function. So yeah. So then when we have as I mentioned, when we have the link for this down, we basically add the RB link node will add the new node to that link in the bottom, and the insert color will do the rebalancing. So that's actually transparent to the interfaces, but we still need to control the for users. Are there any questions about this? All right. So these are some of the things that are left done. We need more real-world testing. Unfortunately, my machines were taken from me a little bit, so I haven't been able to actually continue doing these tests. But that the real-world workloads, the benchmarks, that will show us whether or not this is worth having or not. We need to get the threaded RB trees upstream. Again, I'm really hesitating with that because I don't have the full interfaces yet. I'm trying to do it with the least cost of modifying the every RB tree user in the kernel. What Sasha was saying about ways to avoid the tree lock, it's probably very dangerous because we're giving up a lot of the guarantees that tree lock that a spring lock gives us. But it definitely is a single point of contention. And with that, we can probably get the actual range locking in the kernel. So this is, I'm sorry, one more thing in the to-do was we actually also have patches to convert the MAP-SEM to a full range lock. And I say full because that's the first step. and to enable the parallelism. Once we have the conversion done, and once we have the actual primitive in the kernel, we can start looking at making it not a full range lock, but the actual range that the user passes for the system call. There's currently a V3 of the patch. That's a little old, maybe. But the main thing that patch has that doesn't need it is the, before we used to, when I initially introduced this, the fast overlap checks were part of the range lock, and now they're part of the actual RB tree and interval tree infrastructure. So we actually need to get rid of that. But other than that, that's pretty much the code we have right now. And then there's the LWN article, which provides some detail about the things I discussed in the semantics, as well as use cases. Other potential users than MapSim is DAX. And we have also a user which is only writers for the Lustre file system, but with the performance enhancements, that should also be replaced. Thank you. Any questions?
Are any of the red black tree accesses read only, or do they always involve the write?
Well, when you're looking for the overlaps, it involves read only. I'm not sure I follow.
So you're starting at the root of the tree, and you start there 100 times. Out of that 100, how many of those accesses involve a write versus how many involve only reads?
Well, we're always reading and writing to the tree for every call, because the read part I was mentioning is finding out how many intersections there are, and then the write part is actually adding it to the tree.
Okay, so every invocation involves a read.
Yes, yes, yeah. And the way we give mutual exclusion is just by after the node is added, you just block.
Okay. The reason I ask is there is an RCU version of red black trees.
Yes.
But that you only win if there are read only accesses to the tree.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also have some loose guarantees for red black tree iterations, but they have no guarantees as to their actual correctness. So we can basically speculate. We basically know that the values are there, the loads and the stores, but you can't really know if you're in the middle of a traversal, for example. So for the locking concept, I don't quite see that as working. But it is certainly interesting to look at an RCU RCU aware tree. Yeah, that could be helpful. Yeah. So there's also a, for example, just another detail, when we have an interruptible case or a killable case, we have to know how we have to back off to abort the operation, because we've already added the node to the tree. For that, we also rely on a different sequence counter that basically lets us in the unlikely case get to that. But overall, the structure is smaller than a regular read-write semaphore. I think by 30 bytes, but I'm not sure. I had those measurements. I forgot them now. But that is another pro to this, because it alleviates some of the footprint.
Can you give me an idea at what scale you expect this to be useful? For example, if you're dealing with 10 ranges, then like who cares? But if you know, where does this start becoming actually useful performance-wise?
So it's as useful as amount of, in my particular case, the memory operations are going on. Right now, every memory operation will block each other because it's basically doing a downwrite on a semaphore. So it shouldn't make a difference if it's a lot or small. That'll depend on the workload. And it, not only that, but like if you have a lot of scenarios where you're using a full lock in the range, you're going to be blocking everybody else. So maybe that's not a good idea either. It only serves when you have non-overlapping work on non-overlapping regions of the address space. So that will depend a lot on the user, not the user of the range lock, but the workload going on top. Any other questions? All right, just 5 minutes early. Thank you for your time.